Welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and this week I am joined once again by Drs. Scott Keith and Adam Francisco. On today's episode, we are going to be talking about expertism. I'm sure people right now, if you've been watching the news with coronavirus, you're used to being told what to do and what's going on by lots of experts. You may be sick of it when it comes to coronavirus. Heck, you may be sick of it when it comes to things like this podcast. Maybe you're sick of these fellows, these theological quote-unquote experts. So we're going to dive into that today. Before we do that, I would like to highlight one of the shows, one of the projects at 1517.org. We have The Craft of Preaching, which is a project that was built to help pastors hone their craft. Each week, The Craft of Preaching has articles that include written by pastors, seminary professors, and they're on the weekly lectionary readings that you might preach off of for Sunday morning. And you can go there. And again, they're not writing sermons for you. These are sermon helps. The entire project is designed to assist you in thinking through the text. And I think part of it also is to make you feel like you're not alone in doing this. You know, Paul Koch and Bob Hiller, who head up the project, have been on the show before. And they talk often about how this idea stemmed from meetings that they would have with pastors in their local circuits, and how they would go to bars or restaurants and sit down over a beer and talk about weekly texts. And so I think they're trying to, in part, replicate that, but in a broader scale. So you can go to 1517.org/craft of preaching to see all of that. All right, guys. So, expertism. I think everybody's sort of well aware of this phenomena or issue right now. I know one of the things that goes on with coronavirus is you'll see people sort of spread information, whether that be on Twitter or Facebook, radio shows, heck, even the Thinking Fellows. And that information is then quickly countered either by an expert or maybe by an armchair expert. And so I think there's a lot of question about how do you trust where information's coming from? Are experts the only people you can trust? Can you do this? Where do we want to go with this episode?
Well, I always think it's interesting and I think important for somebody is perceived as an expert to go ahead and acknowledge sort of their limitations. And I think this is an important thing when you're seeking out information and you're looking for sources of authority. And if that source of authority sort of lands on a person, that person hopefully is honest about, you know, what their field of study is and what their field of study is not. One of the most honest people about that I've ever met is Dr. Rosenblatt. I mean, he will literally say that it's not his field, even if it's been something that he's been interested in and studied for 20 years, if it's not something that he was formally educated on. And, you know, maybe that's going too far sometimes, but I think on this show, you know, this is a show with quote-unquote experts in a way. You know, you have PhDs of various stripes and various emphases and giving opinions on theological matters, historical matters, philosophical matters. But I think one of the things that why I asked to do this show today is I've been trying to lose some weight, which means every morning I go on like an hour-long walk, which gives me a lot of time to listen to podcasts. And because we're in coronavirus and whatnot, a lot of the podcasts I've listened to are political. And inevitably, you know, you either have pundits, which are basically journalists, which aren't really experts on anything, maybe except for collecting data and information and sharing it. But then they'll bring on experts, you know, economist, epidemiologist, whatever. And it's just interesting to me that when times get uncertain, we search for information about what's going on during these uncertain times. And we sort of gravitate towards listening to people who supposedly know more about the topic than we do for whatever reason. And I think there's some good in that. I think there's some danger in that. I think in a way, it's probably not a historically new phenomenon, but I think in America, and Adam can probably speak to this better than I can, but I know that there was an evolution of sort of trusting in experts and what you might call expertism that came along during sort of the Woodrow Wilson administration and sort of the progressive movement and progressive era of that time. As Rudin, you really sort of, in America too, get a reliance on, I would say science, but to reveal my bias, I don't actually think it's science usually. I think it's like scientists and scientism that's often relied on more than just the science. I would be happier if it were the science that we're solely relied on, but that's, you know, anytime you bring in an expert, you're having, even if there is scientific data behind what they're saying, you're having that person give you an their interpretation of the data, which is not the same thing as just the data.
Right.
And so, anyway, that movement in American culture and American history and American politics has been very interesting to me. You've seen this, we could see this in the 20th century too in theology when, you know, I think the sort of liberal / neo-orthodox movements of the 20th century were driven by experts who had a better education, quote unquote, than your sort of small town pastor. You know, the best of the best were sent off to do European doctorates, often from Germany, and came back as experts, and the expertism that they brought back to American theology, the theological landscape was much more liberal than what had existed before. So that's what I wanted to do.
Well, let's, yeah, let's just, I mean, do it then. And just, I think you said one of the things to do is to acknowledge that you have limitations. So we recorded an episode recently that was a little more political than normal, right? Even though we're not politicians or political theorists, I guess,
or professionally.
Or pundits.
Which one was that?
We did
Is
one.
Is it one I wasn't on?
No, you were on.
No, you were
it.
On.
Oh, okay.
We called in. It was the last one we called in for.
Oh, okay. That wasn't really that political.
Yeah, it didn't go as political as we thought it could have. Yeah.
And I think that was partially, there was like a, you know,
we're hesitant to do that.
Right.
Because we don't want to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of reasons. I don't want to alienate listeners who have different political views than I might have by saying this position or that position is stupid. And I don't intend to do that even today. Like, I'm not even trying to say that a move towards relying on experts is any worse than, say, a move towards relying on another source of authority. All I'm trying to point out is that if we do this blindly, it's a bad epistemology.
Mm.
I mean, you're going to end up trusting somebody who's either maybe intentionally, maybe not intentionally, steering you wrong and is trusted for the sake of their supposed knowledge.
So why don't we pick a couple of maybe what we could call myths about experts to address and then just address them directly. I've got a couple in my head that I'm thinking of. One particularly that I think just keeps coming up right now, and I think specifically the issue of scientism runs into this one a lot, and science in general, is that if you are an expert in a field, you will not have a bias to a particular outcome of data sets or information in that field, but you will present the information as taken in. What do we deal with that? What do we say to that?
I mean, I think of one example, kind of a popular example, would be Richard Dawkins, who I've read in several places is brilliant at evolutionary biology. Mm. But when he talks philosophy, public policy, ethics, whatever, terrible. He's David Berlinski once described him as a reptile when it comes to those fields. So somebody can, like you're saying, be an expert on a particular topic. And I mean, our listeners should know, I'm sure we have some who have done graduate work in X, Y, or Z, but just because somebody has a PhD does not mean that they know things outside that real specialized topic that they studied.
Yeah.
That's the problem. Like you mentioned, scientism. You know, science should be, in a way, is authoritative if it's legitimate science.
Sure.
But
it's
oftentimes,
the investigation, data to for the purposes of seeking information. And sometimes, if it's done right, you know, that data can be verified, it can be falsified, it can be examined by other people and other sources, all that type of thing.
Mm-hmm. But it steps outside of its scope, all of a sudden it becomes, I've used the term probably way too much in the past, but ideological, which has a very much a political component. And I think this is me laying down my cards a bit, but like with currently, it's really hard to know what the heck's going on because science is being used by all sorts of parties and interpreted through a political lens.
Yeah.
And it's
I see.
Hard to know.
So that's one of the ones where I think we could do this with multiple disciplines, right? Where you have something you want to be true, and if there's a subset of data that supports that, even tangentially, you can sort of use it. So, I mean, let's say I just really like the idea of electric cars, which I don't, but let's just say I do. If there's some subset of data that says that they're better than gasoline cars, both in terms of efficiency or fun to drive or something like that, I might cling to whoever said that and be able to use an expert for my argument without engaging the totality of the data. Same thing could be done in theology, right?
Same thing could be done, just to play devil's advocate, in favor of advocating for sticking with internal combustion for the rest of all time. Like you could find data that would support that it's that it's
more efficient,
cleaner, that's more efficient, that's more reliable, blah blah blah, on down the line. It doesn't mean that that's the totality of data. It doesn't mean that that takes into account unknown variables. It doesn't even mean it takes into account all the known variables. That's the thing. I think the biggest danger here, and I'd be interested to hear Adam's take on this, is that I think experts are studied in a particular field, which means that they've done research, right? That they've not only sat in classrooms and absorbed information, but they've taken that time sitting in classrooms and absorbing, and they've turned it around into doing some kind of research that's somewhat unique and has brought to the fore a conclusion that can be either verified by a group of their peers or challenged by a group of their peers. And that makes you an expert, right? The problem with research, I mean, the constant ongoing bane of any researcher is their own confirmation bias. The fact that when we set out to research something, we're usually interested in that topic, which means that we usually already have somewhat of an opinion about that topic. And it could be anything. It could be like your political opinions or whatever. And the minute you let go of keeping focus on the fact that your confirmation bias might be a problem in this research, and you let go of it because you believe that your current view is correct or whatever, you will find the research to support your conclusion. You'll find it.
Yeah.
And because it's not that hard. I mean, people, even in history and historical theology, people like Luther and Melanchthon and Chemnitz, they said so many things.
You can find almost
anything. That if you kind of take context and throw it away and you focus on just what you think they should have said, you will find some support for it, likely, especially if it's in the realm of quote-unquote reason.
I once sat in a seminar on Luther studies. I don't remember the exact title, but it was about Luther and his theology and his life and so on. And every week or however often we met, there would be a paper would be delivered on a particular topic. And it was really interesting to me. We'd get the papers ahead of time. I'd read through some of those papers. I don't want to talk about any particular issue because I don't want to trigger anybody or name names, but it was all but certain to me that most of those papers were written by people who had something they wanted to prove from Luther.
Yeah.
And they would go to a table of contents, or the index, or now with these searchable databases, they'd go and find the proof text from Luther to support that particular argument or thesis they're making. But they'd ignore whole swaths of other data from Luther that didn't contradict what they're arguing, but shed more light on it.
Yeah. Also, didn't highlight what they're trying to prove as much, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think, personally, I have such a high view of sin that I think that everybody's susceptible to this.
Yeah.
You know, and
I've heard that about you.
Yeah. The only people, you know, that I trust are the people that say, yes, I too am very susceptible to this. The ones I don't trust are the ones that say, well, I've been trained to rise above it. I'm not sure that's entirely possible. Now, that makes me quasi-postmodern, right? Because that's sort of one of the
What makes you not modernist?
Yeah.
So
it's one of the tenets that I actually appreciate about postmodern movement in general is just a basic sort of questioning of previous norms. But I think that's very empirical. I think that at the end of the day, we should question. My mom accused me of this not too long ago, last time I was out in Nevada, and have of teaching this to Autumn, my daughter, of questioning everything. You know, I question everything. Any politician, even if he's got the letter after his name that I most frequently identify with, or her name, I question what they're saying because there are always agendas. I don't think, you know, there's a scientist that exists that doesn't have an opinion about how their research should be used,
right,
to benefit quote unquote benefit mankind, and that worries me.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, oftentimes there's a motivation which causes you to do the research anyways. When somebody is drafted into doing some research, it's often because they had an interest. They propose the research project. I think it's uncommon or less common to see somebody who has no interest at all in what they're researching, has no reason. And whether that's a political ends or some sort of other ends, that's one of those things that is nice to have disclosed, is that I have an interest in X because of whatever. I mean,
mm-hmm. The first thing, in a sense, I think it should be the first thing you do when you sort of set down to explain whatever research it is that you've done. Mm-hmm. You need to explain your priors.
Yeah. Oftentimes in classes, my first week or so, I'll go over what we generally in history call historiography. You know, who's written what on the particular thing we're looking at for that semester. Right. And then I'll throw in my two cents and, you know, how I approach, let's say, medieval history to lay down my cards. And I try to be as honest as possible and say, listen, I'm a Lutheran, a Protestant.
Yep.
I'm very well aware that my tradition has certain pitfalls or shortcomings when it comes to interpreting data from the Middle Ages. I'm going to try to avoid that, but you should be aware of it because if it comes out in class, feel free to question me on it.
Right.
That just, in many ways, that sort of honesty about our presuppositions or assumptions or our worldview or whatever you want to call it, actually helps or aids in the long run our discovery of what is objectively true.
We hosted a Zoom. I'm not going to get into the names. Maybe some of the listeners will pick it up because they were in on it. But we hosted a Zoom chat not too long ago, and one of the other people that were helping give the answers to the Q&A said more than once, well, that person's got a PhD, so I'll defer to them. And I kind of loudly said back, even though it wasn't my turn, that doesn't make them right.
Right.
That doesn't make them right. I mean, let's just put it out there. Just because somebody's an epidemiologist, that doesn't make them right about their opinion on coronavirus. It might, and it might make them, the possibility of them being right,
higher
because they've done more research
right.
than you and are trained to interpret that research and to catalog the data and all that kind of thing. But it doesn't necessarily make them right. And I think we gotta start believing that. Just because somebody holds a certification, I'll call it, in something, does not make them correct. You could have as much a guess and be right about what's wrong with your car as a mechanic. Now, once your mechanic gets into the diagnostics of what's wrong and starts collecting the data and putting it together, their estimation of what is actually going on with your car is probably greater than yours, but it has more to do with their investigation.
The
fact that we call them a mechanic.
And there would still be information to process to see if, you know, this mechanic was actually trying to fix your problem or trying to make things worse than it was, right? So if you say you're coming in with...
That's a really high view of sin.
Well, yeah. I mean, I worked at a car dealership. I know.
I know from where I speak on this.
Yeah. That, you know, if you come in and you say, my car is shuttering when it's braking, and they come in and tell you, oh, it's you know, you need a whole engine rebuild. That you may need to think about that before they say, let's true the rotors or replace the rotors on the brake, right?
Yeah. That's exactly it. And I think, you know, this gets into what we do a lot, which is epistemology. But this is so important. And one of the things, I've said it time and time again when we do the shows on epistemology, that everybody has sources of authority upon which they rely to make decisions about their life. The biggest thing you can do is ask, are those sources of authority, be they a person or a book or a worldview or whatever, are they trustworthy? And how do I know that they are trustworthy?
So one of the phrases that I like, this is, you know, I don't want it to be just a straw man, but I actually heard on repeat is, specifically when it comes to the coronavirus situation that we're in, is, well, we just need to trust the experts. Trust the experts.
Well, which ones?
Yeah, right.
Well, or in California, we will, this is getting a little more political than I wanted to, but we will open when the science tells us.
Right.
Mike, what does that actually mean? I mean, a priest could say, we will open when God tells us to open. And it almost means the same thing, because within the priestly system, they're the only ones that have access to the information from God and are the ones that are responsible for gathering, collating, and
telling you what God
handing
said.
Over that information,
right,
without anybody else knowing how they did it or how they got to those conclusions. That's the same thing as saying the science will tell us, unless the data is being put out there for others to examine.
And I cannot reasonably just trust the experts. I want to know things like you said, like what methodology are the experts using? Are they being open about how they are
was the data, the research, and the conclusions open to peer review? Were there any dissenting opinions? Who were those dissenting opinions?
Right. And maybe not everybody's interested in that, but there is actually, I think, we need to get away from the idea that you should shame people who will not just fall in line to trusting with faith. That is faith, people. That is not science. That's faith. When somebody says, just trust the experts, and you do, like, whether it's science or theology or whatever it is. If somebody says, just trust the thinking fellows on this, that's having faith.
It's a bad idea.
And you shouldn't do that.
They might be drinking.
Right.
the people listening or the fellows?
Does it have to be either or?
Yeah.
Now, I just, you know, this is the thing, and this is going to probably get me in trouble, which is fine. I'm not bowing to any priest. I'm just not. Our theological system, when it's done well, is set up for a type of peer review, right? We don't have, we don't say that our pastors know everything and could never be wrong just because they went to seminary. We actually hope and encourage our parishioners to compare what is said and taught against Holy Writ. And if they can find a divergence there, they should call that out, first privately to their pastor and then kind of go from there. But they should call it out. They should say, wow, you said this, and you know, Galatians and Ephesians and Romans say this, and they don't seem to come together. What's going on here? That's a type of peer review, right? And my problem with the expert culture is not the experts, or not that they possibly know more in their field than I do. They likely do. It's that so often the information that they're dealing with is hidden from me, and their conclusions are so public.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's... I mean, that's a big part of it. I have heard people say things about this show that make me uncomfortable, about where I've tried to go correct people, where like, well, you shouldn't just, you know, listen to everything we say as the end all be all. And when
well, especially on this episode, I am not an expert on expertism. I don't know if Adam is, but I...
Nope.
Yeah.
Right.
It's a phenomena that is publicly being displayed. It's been...
Yeah.
Sort of, it's being hyped.
I'd say a lot
right
of what
now.
We're doing now is sort of rank opinion mixed with a little bit of training in epistemology.
Yeah, we should probably approach the opposite end of the spectrum, too. There is, we want to avoid a skepticism that opens you up to every conspiracy theory that's out there.
Yeah,
as
that's
well.
A good one.
Yeah, I am susceptible to that.
Oh, yeah, me too. I mean, especially now, I'm like believing everything.
Yeah.
5G. Bill Gates. I'm just kidding. But
I heard the other day that some people believe that if they get the Bill Gates vaccine, that it's going to make them want to buy more Windows products. And I said, I don't know.
Maybe.
Sounds kind of reasonable to me.
Yeah. If I start looking at Windows computers, you know that's true.
Yeah, yeah. That's true.
No, I think that's an important, like the other side of this, right, is, and I tried to say this at the beginning of the show, but you sort of have the Facebook experts too, right, who, and this is...
And the Twitter experts. And
that's me, yeah.
Well, at least you owned it.
And
you know Caleb's in a Twitter spat when he smiles constantly.
Oh, yeah?
That's a sign.
No, that's a sign that I think that I'm winning.
Yeah.
No, you can get that, right? Where somebody sort of just, and you see it a lot with conspiracy theories, you see it a lot with theology, right? people make very certain assertions on social media, the internet, and it's sort of like I'm the expert now. And then you see the reaction to that, and it's sort of an interesting battle that I've been observing a lot with people. Right?
Here's what you could say: just because you trust scientists doesn't mean that you know anything or trust science, and just because you distrust scientists doesn't mean you know the opposite of that. You could be very well scientifically educated and distrust the scientists. I mean, I trust the scientific method quite a bit. Like I'm a big proponent for applying more of that to theological study, but I have a harder and harder time watching news shows that have scientists on them and thinking that those scientists are simply conveying to me the raw data.
So I guess the question that would be looming here when we put sort of two dramatic backdrops out is then, if I can't trust myself, I can't trust the Facebook experts, I can't always trust the educated experts.
That's where Adam was going. destroying all trust.
Yeah. How do I know? Anything's real at all?
Well, probably because you're going to bang your knee on it.
Yeah, that's right. I'm down with that.
Yeah. We did an episode on vocation not too long ago, right? Yeah. I mean, I kind of think maybe like I've lately gotten off, except for like real estate and emails and things. I've kind of gotten off all the intrawebs because it just drives me nuts.
I'm telling you, man. Right? Instagram and full of trucks and airplanes. Happy place.
Yeah, I don't even want to look at that, though. Plus, also my eyes. I get headaches, you know, a small little screen. But because I buy cheap readers at...
Yeah, that you wear as distance
at
glasses.
At Walmart, $3.99 a pair of glasses.
Now we know. Talk about science.
But no, wait. He has vision insurance. Here's just so everybody knows.
But what I do know is I've got four little kids. Well, one not so little. He's taller than me now.
I'd say...
And I've got a wife.
You've got like three that aren't so little.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I've got four children.
Yeah.
I've got a wife. I've got a house. I've got a job. And that's what I'm going to focus on, doing that stuff and doing it right.
Right. And I think you can know even more than that to a reasonable degree of... I would say certainty, but I'll say more... I could say certainty, you know, enough certainty to act on.
Well, like when we go out, when we have to go out to... we don't really all go to the grocery store anymore, but let's say we're going on a walk. They're like, should we wear masks? No. In my car, don't wear a mask. You see these people driving in masks and jogging with masks. Yeah. But if we're going into a store, we should probably put one on.
Yeah.
Let's just err on the side of caution.
That's part of what got me thinking about this is that, you know, I see so many people that are doing the things that they're supposed to be doing, and it bothers me when they do things like they're alone in a car and they have a mask on. It bothers me more than it should.
Yeah.
but it bothers me because I feel like they don't know why they ever wear a mask if they're doing that. And nobody's given them this is my point. Nobody's given them the information about why wearing masks is helpful or can cut the transmission of the disease or whatever. They've just been told, by an expert, wear a mask. And so they wear a mask.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, that's fine. It shouldn't bother me that much.
Yeah.
But at the same time, this is part of the problem is that we act on information. We should be acting on information. And if that information is given to us by an expert who's better equipped to explain to us the importance of the information, that's one thing. But if it's just, I wear a white lab coat and I say, wear a mask, and thus you do, that's scary stuff. Mm-hmm. Historically, that's gone bad for people and nations.
Yeah.
About 80 years ago.
Yeah, it's gone real bad.
Yeah, no, you definitely, I mean, I think there has been that's the striking shift where you start to be uncomfortable is where things like, move from openness of information about what's going on and the ability to
decrees.
Right. That then the information flow also stops. So when the decrees start and the information faucet's been shut off, that's troubling.
Yeah. I'll give one more example. It's just going to get us in trouble and Caleb can just cut this whole show if he needs to. But parking lots here in California, right? Public places are open, beaches and whatnot, for use, but the parking lots aren't open. Now, there might be a good reason for that. There could be. I don't know. I don't know because I'm not told why the parking lots aren't open. I'm just told, well, you can go surf, but you can't park at the surfing spot.
Yeah, that's a problem.
Okay. Again, there could be very good reason why the parking lots are closed, but I don't know. I've heard on the radio probably 30 times that they are closed, but I've never once heard on the radio why they're closed. Okay, this 6 feet of separation. Now, I can infer, right, why
6 feet matters.
6 feet matters, but I've actually never been told this study showed that 6 feet's the magic number, not 5 feet because of this, 20 feet, just that's just overkill because of X, Y, and Z.
I'm pretty sure it's more than that. I mean, I mentioned last, I think it was one of the episodes we did a week or two ago. I think this is political.
I got you. The views and opinions of the Thinking Fellows on this episode are not representative of those of 1517 and the whole, and merely closing, the opinions of the host.
The closing of the parking lots at Doheny State Beach, where we go to surf, I think are more an attempt to keep people from congregating because they know full well people can't govern themselves. They're just going to do whatever the heck they want.
I agree.
I think that's why that's being done. It's not.
I think so too. But it's never been explained to me. Now let me give you an example.
I get it though. Oh, I totally get it. Because have you been around people?
Okay, so Caleb and I go to the brewery yesterday.
Yes, yeah. This
is Docent Brewery.
You went.
Listen up. It's not open. Don't get upset.
Thanks for the invite.
Okay, don't get upset. We didn't invite you. It's not open.
Oh.
We ordered the beer ahead of time.
Right.
And we went for pickup.
Support your local brewery. Keep them open.
So we went and pick up the beer. Lo and behold, there are, you know, the train tracks that run right behind us.
Oh, yeah.
There are groups of people sitting on the wall next to the train tracks, smoking their cigarettes and drinking their beer, all in groups of 8 or 10, like they would be
anyways
inside.
And we walked down, so we were walking down past the restaurants last night in San Clemente. And one of the restaurants, all of them have pickup.
Oh, this is the one on the corner that I don't like.
Yeah, but one of them allows you to drink a beer on the patio while you're waiting for pickup.
Right.
There were like 30 people packed into this patio with a completely empty, massive, probably 4,000-foot dining space.
So, but this is what you get when you just tell people what to do and you don't give them the reason. The same thing with parenting, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If you just tell your kids, don't touch the stove, you know, they might not touch the stove and they might get in trouble for touching it once or twice and then they don't do it anymore. But if you actually explain, you know, as they get older, explain to them, well, you don't touch the stove because the stove, if somebody's been cooking, is very hot and you don't know when people have been cooking or not cooking. So it's a good practice just not to touch it at all. And because we don't want you to get hurt, you don't want you to get hurt, da, 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 da. And you give them the information, they're less likely to desire to touch the stove. So
yeah, especially if you can show them the consequence of touching the stove.
Sinful nature being what it is, if you just tell people don't do it, some won't, right? But a lot will do as much as they possibly can, even if they, quote unquote, support the rule, right? Well, I'm still following the rule. I didn't go in. Well, yeah, but you're with a group of 10 people on the patio.
Yeah.
I know, but the rule is don't go in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is why this doesn't work.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, maybe to bring it back to our normal thing, I think you can apply the same thing to, and you know, some people might be upset about this, but going to church. If you talk to people about why do you go to church, the answer you get is often, well, God wants me to be there, or I need to go there because, you know, good Christians go to church and stuff. It's very rare to be directly communicated, even within Lutheranism, I think it's not always the best communicated that the reason that the church exists is to distribute God's gifts to them, right?
Yeah,
and you're supposed to, and it's clear when you talk to people that you actually need to tell them that reason because the reason they infer that they should be going
to
church
the best one,
is not always the best one, right? It's maybe an adjacent explanation, but it's you know, it's generally the disposition is not the right one.
Yeah.
And, I don't know. Is there anything else we want to? Your legal qualification statement.
Yeah, I think four times we said this is going to get me in trouble.
Yeah, it is. But I had to talk about it. I mean,
by the way, when we say that, we don't mean like that. There's some authority that's going to get rid of the Thinking Fellows. We mean that like your angry emails are going to come to Caleb's inbox, and
this is going to get Caleb in trouble.
This is going to give Caleb some extra reading to do this week.
Oh, it's just Caleb. Let's go. Let's keep going.
No, I hope people take this for what it is. For me, this is basically, this is more of an epistemological issue. And
our favorite topic outside of the theology.
That drives me crazy. Like, this is bad as saying, well, I believe that because I read it in Reader's Digest. It's like, okay.
Well, I mean, there is so much to be learned here about epistemology and who do you trust. Yeah. And I mean, thinking as a college professor, this illustrates very well. Like, you're bombarded with information, and it comes from different sources. How are you going to be able to navigate which sources you trust? And so what we used to call, I don't know if they still do it, but critical thinking is absolutely essential in our day and age.
I know if anybody in the future that I'm connected with ever has the ability to change a curriculum at a university, I would really twist their arm to bring back a straight critical thinking class or just basic logic class that's not as abstract as...
Like informal fallacies and those sorts of things.
You know, not like real formal logical mathematical propositions as much as like informal fallacies and just critical thinking.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if we can ever convince somebody to do that.
Yeah, there might be somebody who has that ability one day. Yeah, I think, a lot of this... The epistemology thing actually gets back to the question I asked a little while ago, which is how can we trust or know anything at all? And I think the answer is to first examine why you believe something that somebody says. That way you can actually see if the way that information is being relayed lines up with that way with which you know is consistently helped you determine if something's right, wrong, what the answer to the problem is, if X, Y, or Z are going to happen. And you alluded to that with empiricism. And
check your priors, and watch out for confirmation bias and everything.
And if you know that about yourself, it's easier to help determine where you're going to get your information from. And ultimately, one of the things, we talk about how sort of the internet, social media, news is annoying, but one of the things that we have is a lot of individual power to tailor that. And that can be good or bad. That can be bad because you can do a lot of confirming your own biases by only listening to media that confirms everything you already believe. But the other thing about that is that you can, once the noise becomes annoying or unhelpful, you can shut it off. You actually have the ability to say, man, I'm sick of watching the news. I'm sick of being completely unsure and yet being told I have to do everything this way. I'm just going to turn it off for a little while. And I think more of us, including myself, probably need to do that before we get so upset that we're done with everything.
Yeah.
So,
is that 40 minutes? 45 minutes?
No, it's 37. That's not bad. I mean, we're right on time. Unless you guys have
minutes
to
gripe.
Oh, no. I got a lot of griping in me. Maybe we should cut it a little short.
Yeah, we should.
Let's
probably
get
should.
Political.
No, we already did.
Can you cut it in that song, Let's Get Physical?
No, we can't cut
that's
it.
That's Olivia Newton-John.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's right. I really liked her when I was 12.
Well, hey there, guys. Thank you for listening to this episode. We appreciate your time. I understand that most people have actually been listening to less podcasts lately as they haven't been driving to work or spending as much time in the car, which is where most people listen to the podcast. But if you have been listening to the Think Fellows consistently, we thank you for your time. We also thank you for your support. And if you could consider continuing to support the show, you can do that one of two ways or both ways. Preferably, you can go to Apple Podcasts. There's a link at the top of this episode, and you can leave a review if you have not done so yet. I know for many of our listeners do not use the Apple Podcasting app, but if you could take the 5 minutes to divert your way over there, whether it's from your computer or your phone, and leave a short 5-star review, those are extraordinarily helpful. And the second way that you can help us, you go to 1517.org/give. And over there, you can set up a donation, either one time or reoccurring, that can help support the efforts of 1517 and the podcasting network here. We understand that people are under financial stress right now, so if you're not able to, we understand. But if you could please consider it either for now or in the future, we would really appreciate that. Thank you for listening to this episode. We'll catch you next time. Bye.